If you want to learn more about the topics of today's episode, visit the podcast website at naturesecretservice.com. Thanks for listening. Okay, people, listen up. Here we go. This is Nature Secret Service, the podcast that puts you in the room with the men and women of wildlife law enforcement. I'm Ed Newcomer, your host, and today our guest is Sean Mann, former special agent with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Sean and I were actually classmates at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, the Academy for Federal Agents. So I've known him, we knew each other our whole careers, and he was a special agent for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service between 2002 until his retirement in 2024. So, Sean, thank you for joining us. It's great to have you here. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Yeah, it's awesome to be here, Ed. Good to see you.
Yeah, same. Good to see you, too. I do have to say, I want to give you a compliment right off the bat. You know, you have a background. You were in the Army for a long time, right? How long were you in the Army?
23 years.
23 years. And you did, you know, tours in, starting in, I think, Somalia, right? You were in Somalia?
I was in Africa. I was all over the place. Yeah.
All over the place.
I was all over the place.
Yeah. I know you did Afghanistan for a while. You were a drill sergeant. You have a long career. You know, but what the compliment I'm going to pass you is when you and I were at the academy together, you know, I overall thought the academy was fun. I think you did too. I had a great time when we went to the law enforcement training center together to be agents. But of course, you know, in that setting, there's always stressful days. There's hard days. There are days you're just sick of the instructors. But you, I mean, I don't remember a day of you ever being in a bad mood. And I have to be honest with you, you were always like a source of levity, you know, encouragement. You know, whether it was at the dining hall and you'd crack a joke and make everybody laugh, or whether it was during some training exercise where we were stressed out. One I remember in particular was our boat operating training where we had, it was kind of stressful for me because I hadn't done that before.
Oh yeah.
And you just made everybody laugh, and you always pointed out the fun side of all of it. And I'll never forget that about you. And it's not something you normally associate with a guy who was a drill sergeant in the U.S. Army.
Well, I think I probably hit it well, because I, at least during the academy, was stressed every day.
Were you?
Yeah. And it was, and I became even more stressed when, if you recall, one of our classmates had failed, I think, Legal One.
Yes.
And then I was trying to help that individual study. And it wasn't until that moment that I realized, when he revealed to me that, well, if I fail this, then I'm gone. Mm-hmm. That's my safety net. And I was like, what do you mean your safety net? And he's like, Sean, you only get to fail one test.
Right.
And then then you're done. And then that's when I really started to stress out, because I didn't quite realize, or maybe I hadn't been paying attention, that, you know, I had left being a wildlife inspector, and, I loved being a wildlife inspector. But I always wanted to be an agent without question. And that's when I really started to stress out, because I realized, like, shoot, I didn't realize that if you fail one of the major exams, and I thought you get a redo, but I thought you got a redo every time. You only get one. And oh my gosh, I panicked. And
did you?
Oh my gosh, yes.
You didn't show it. You never showed it.
Well, I think, like you, who did a lot of undercover work in your career, I did as well. And I think that was one of the things that probably helped. When you do undercover work, you can't show that stress.
Yeah.
You've got to hide it. You know, you can't show that kind of those stressors that affect you. You've got to have some way of deflecting it or hiding it or masking it. Mine a lot of times is humor, or you've got to just embrace those things that knowing yourself, and just rolling with it. And so, but yeah, no, I was until we got to SABS, you know, the special agent basic school for our portion of it with Fish and Wildlife Service. I relaxed a little bit until we got to the waterfowl ID portion, which I could tell you Donald was a duck, and that was it.
Yeah.
I waterfowl was not my forte. That's probably into this day, in credit to the agents that put on that course. It's the hardest test I've ever taken in my adult life. I mean, yeah. 225 questions, fill in the blank.
Yeah. And identifying birds by wing and feather and some, yeah, crazy.
Yeah. In a blown bag. And then that's, oh my gosh, I still stress about that test when I think about it.
It's probably worth pointing out because, you know, a lot of listeners of the show and watchers are not in law enforcement. So yeah. So the way the training works for federal officers, federal agents is the FBI and the DEA have their own academies at Quantico, but all other federal agents, so whether it's Fish and Wildlife Service, Secret Service, ATF, whatever, they all go to the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center in Glencoe, Georgia, which is called FLETC. And within that program, the first thing that they have to complete is what's called CITP, Criminal Investigator Training Program. And that's the program you go through in order to become a special agent with the U.S. government. And the curriculum at FLETC is basically the same curriculum that FBI agents and DEA agents do at their academies, because obviously we want to make sure we can all work together. Right. But after that initial CITP is done, all of the federal agents go off and do what's called an add-on school, which is specific to their particular area of responsibility. So Fish and Wildlife agents go to what's called SABS, Special Agent Basic School. Secret Service goes off to their own school to learn about what they do. But the basic core training is at CITP, where we all learn the basics of how to be special agents. So, like, for example, Sean, when you and I went to the academy, you remember, I think we were in there with diplomatic security special agents were the main. We had a Forest Service agent that was in our class. But yeah, it could be a mix. You know, you might be sitting next to another Fish and Wildlife agent, or you might be sitting next to a Secret Service agent or an ATF agent in your basic training. But as you mentioned, it's no joke. At CITP, if you do not score, I forget, it's in the low 7, I think 72% or something on every exam, 72 or better, you get one time to do a redo on a test, and that's your one shot. After that, if you do not score above the minimum score required, you're escorted off the facility that day. You're out. You're done.
Yeah.
And that, there is a level of stress there that is present, I think, for all of us. And, you know, there's different aspects of training, the physical training, the firearms training. Each of us had our weaknesses that we were worried about, right?
Yeah. Well, and if you recall, you know, we did lose people in our group. Yeah,
we did. And they were gone. Like that day, they were gone. We never saw them again. Pretty great. Yeah.
You'd go to lunch or you'd go to another training exercise and you'd come back and, you know, you'd see their little area and it had already been collected up and
empty
and scrubbed and they were gone. You didn't see them again.
Not just gone. They were off the base. Yeah. Crazy. And then you referenced the waterfowl identification course, which is something that is part of the special agent basic school specifically for Fish and Wildlife agents. And I'll tell you this, Sean, you know, I'm a lawyer and I practiced law before I became an agent. So I had to take and pass state bar exams. And the only reason I bring that up is because that waterfowl identification class, my brain has not hurt as the only time my brain hurt that bad studying for an exam was when I was studying for a state bar exam to become a lawyer. I mean, that was one of the hardest tests I have ever taken in my life. That was brutal.
I tell you.
I mean, I remember we'd just be up studying till midnight in that class looking at bird wings and bird feathers and carcasses trying to get the ID down. That was a crazy time, wasn't it?
It was. And, you know, of course, you know, I went on to eventually become a senior special agent at FLETC.
Right. That's right.
And running a SABS class. And I tell you, it's like, you know, having like what I would refer to as like basic training flashbacks or something, you know, when you start getting out those wings and the guys that were coming in to teach that class, you know, and I start getting sick to my stomach and, you know, my head starts hurting and it's like, oh gosh, you know, and, but there's a, you know, there's like a badge of honor knowing that you passed that course
of 100%,
you know,
and to this day,
it's legitimate.
You know? Yeah. And to this day, if I ask you what a widgeon feather is, you're going to know exactly what that is, aren't you? You better know what a widgeon.
Maybe not as well as I used to.
You better know what a widgeon.
I'm better
widgeon feather is.
Better now than I was then, but I think I got an 82 on the test.
I don't recall what I got. I just know I passed. That's all that mattered.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely was better coming out of that test than going in. I was definitely better on my Raptors than I was, you know, which was obviously a separate test. You know, having a Raptor ID test.
Yeah, Raptor ID.
But. Oh yeah. My head still rolls, you know, when I think about that, that was, you know, and to know that was at Lee in our class, you know, he missed one on that entire test. And it's just like, you know, it's like, that's respect to you, sir.
It only matters that you pass, you know, that reminds me your long career. You were a wildlife inspector before you came an agent, which is the uniformed, you know, inspection division of the Office of Law Enforcement. But you had a really cool kind of well-rounded career. You spent time as a training agent at FLETC, Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, where you inevitably, you know, undoubtedly helped many new agents through the training process. But you also ended your career as a resident agent in charge in the northeastern U.S. So you had a great opportunity to be a supervisor. And then you started your career as a field agent in Region 1 on the West Coast, same region I was in. We didn't work in the same field office, but we were in the same region. And that's where I want to jump to today, because since we're talking about birds, we might as well talk about eagles. And one of the great fun cases that you did involved some straight up eagle poachers that ended up not just being people who were out there shooting eagles, but they were trafficking in eagle parts. And I think, you know, law enforcement, wildlife law enforcement people are definitely going to know what that's about. But I would bet most of our listeners have no clue that eagle parts have value, that they're trafficked, that there's a demand for them, and people are out there killing eagles. So before we jump into the case, if you don't mind, I want to give just a quick background on what the situation with eagles in the U.S., the laws that protect them, and then you jump in if I miss anything or I get anything wrong. So basically, there's two eagles native to North America. It's the bald eagle and the golden eagle. And I think most people would know them if they saw them. But there's two laws in particular that particularly protect eagles. The bald eagle used to be listed under the Endangered Species Act. It has been declared recovered, so it has now been delisted. So it's no longer under the protection of the ESA. But both the bald eagle and golden eagle are protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, which is a 100-year-old law protecting migratory birds. It's illegal to take a bird listed under the MBTA, and to do so would be a Class B misdemeanor, which means punishable by up to 6 months in jail and I think a $25,000 fine. However, under the MBTA, if you take a protected bird with the intent to sell it, then, or if you do sell it, that's actually a Class D felony, which means you go to jail for up to 2 years. And I can't remember what the maximum fine on that is. Do you remember, Sean? It's $100,000 or $250,000. I can't remember on a Class D felony. Not really important, but a lot of money.
Because you'll never get the max penalty anyway.
You never get the max. And but to say the least, anytime it's a felony, that's the critical thing.
Yeah.
The other law that protects eagles, there is a specific law called the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act. It's a federal law, basically just similar prohibitions to what's under the MBTA, but it specifically addresses bald and golden eagles. And that penalty is a Class A misdemeanor for first offense and can turn into a felony for, I think, second or third offenses. I can't remember for sure. Do you recall?
Well, that's what's unique about the statute is first offense is a misdemeanor.
Yeah, Class A. So that's 1 year in jail, $100,000 fine.
And then the second offense is a felony.
Yeah, okay.
And that's what makes that statute unique.
Yeah. and so. Makes it more powerful than in the MBTA. Although, if you get that take with intent to sell under the MBTA, you've got pretty good felony charges.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
Anyway, so that's kind of where we are with Eagles. But across the U.S., Eagles have value in illicit markets, primarily for their feathers and their sometimes their talons or their other body parts.
Yeah.
And I know you worked in the Western U.S. for quite a while. So, you know, there's a lot of eagles in California and the Western U.S. There's bald eagles all over the U.S. now. So let's talk about this. In 2007, you basically become aware of like a straight up eagle poaching case that kind of was uncovered in progress, right?
November 2007. In this case, the dates are a little bit relevant here because it starts to get a little convoluted when you start talking about our subject here. But somebody gets a call from somebody calls the California at the time Cal Fish and Game. They're not that. They're now called California Department of Fish and Wildlife, that suspected eagle poaching north of Bakersfield. So two wardens driving separate vehicles head out there.
This is like a crime in progress gets called in, right? This is happening now.
Yeah, this is happening now.
But most wardens, most game wardens in California and other states, they're uniformed, they drive a marked vehicle. Their essential function is patrol and, you know, immediate enforcement. So unlike a special agent with the Fish and Wildlife Service who doesn't wear a uniform, doesn't drive a marked vehicle, they have radios in their vehicles, they're dispatched, they have specific areas that they patrol. They're kind of perfectly positioned to respond to these kind of crimes in progress, right? So that's kind of cool because even if Fish and Wildlife had gotten the tip, it's not like U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has a dispatcher that could dispatch somebody to go investigate. It's got to be a state game warden who's the beat cop, right? The first responder. They're out there working. Right. They get the call. They're going to roll on it, basically. So it is cool. There were two wardens in the area. They responded. Tell us what they discover.
Well, they were actually in pursuit. One warden was in pursuit and actually pulled over the vehicle that was in question, that was called in on the tip, and was dealing with the subjects in the vehicle. All the while, the other warden found a deceased golden eagle on the side of the road and collected it up as evidence, since the report was that it was eagle poaching.
Right.
Seems appropriate. So
it's a clue.
It's a clue. And you know, again, credit to the wardens for also doing some great evidence collection as well, because without good evidence collection, you really don't have a case either.
This is a great example too of them working with us, because they made the initial contacts, but because you had built relationships with your local wardens, they knew eagle cases are also, they're, you know, federal law. We have primary jurisdiction over eagles, even though it's also a state violation. So they roll up on this car. They've got a dead eagle off the road. The report they got from the informant or from the tipster is somebody's up here shooting eagles. And I assume they gave a description of the car. That's how the wardens found it.
Right. Yeah.
So what did they discover when they pulled this car over and they contacted the people in the car?
So they contacted Kadura Clark.
Okay.
And Kadura Clark was somebody known to the wardens, who has historically been known in that area as somebody who has been reported to sell eagle parts on the Native American powwow circuit. Unfortunately, some people take advantage of the powwow circuits and go there to sell eagle parts and, you know, but certain Native Americans have the right to possess, you know, there's a subsection of the law that allows for them for religious rights and, you know, for their Native American Religious Freedoms Act to possess these things. And they do trade them.
But they can't sell them. That's the difference.
But they cannot sell them. Yeah. That's the difference. Right. Yeah.
And Kadura Clark, is he a native?
Well, that is, well, no.
Right. I mean, he claims he is, but he's not on any. So the way the Native American tribal system works, I guess, is the recognized tribes in the U.S. have a tribal membership role, and they know right. who all the members of the tribe are. So in a situation like this, ultimately, and we'll talk about it later, I assume, is it was possible for you as an investigator to actually check with the tribes and find out if Kadura Clark was indeed an enrolled member.
Right. He claimed to be a certificate of blood enrollment of the Blackfeet tribe in Browning, Montana.
Okay.
Subsequently no registration.
Yeah.
Either at the tribal level or at the federal level. But he claimed that. That's what right. he claimed.
Yeah, yeah, which is not uncommon. So, you for an agent to encounter somebody who's got eagle feathers, they're usually the first thing they'll tell you, whether it's true or not, is that they're a tribal right. member and they're entitled to have them for religious purposes. And just to be clear on this, the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals has made it very clear that you have to be a tribal member in order to take advantage of this right to possess eagle feathers for religious or cultural purposes.
Right.
You cannot be, you know, you or me, Sean, if we adopted Native American religious practices and considered ourselves following those doctrines or practices, that does not entitle us. We have no legal protection to possess an eagle feather. It's limited to you right. must be a member of a recognized tribe. And so it's pretty clear cut right. if you are a member or not a yeah. member. So Kadura Clark, tell us what does Kadura Clark look like? Like physically describe him.
So he's kind of a short, I think he's like, you know, 5'6", 5'7", rotund African American.
Yeah. It's not to say that a black person can't be a member, enrolled member of a tribe, but it's just he's an interesting character in that he's a pretty big dude, right? As far as
he's a big guy.
He steps out of the car, and it's not the first image you have of here's a Native American with eagle feathers for religious purposes, right?
Right, and I you know jokingly I can empathize because, you know, as white as I look, I'm a registered Hawaiian.
That's right. I forgot about that. Yeah, that's true.
So I can empathize with that. You know, if he says, you know, if he looks African-American, but he says he's a registered member of the Blackfeet tribe in Montana. Okay. When I say I'm a registered Hawaiian, I certainly get the raised eyebrow till I slap out. I take out my registration card right. and then, you know, and then that usually dispels, you know, most questions at that point. But yeah, he had fake registration papers. The investigation would later show that they were printed up by his brother.
What happened at this initial traffic stop with Kadura Clark? There was somebody else with Kadura, right? He wasn't alone.
Yeah, Clark. Yeah. Thompson.
Okay. Yeah.
And what did Thompson was his,
that was his buddy.
That was his buddy, Thompson, who's, was known to them as well. But the wardens did a great job of evidence collection. Mm. They looked in the car. They found other migratory bird parts. They found weapons. They found two rifles. They found blood in the trunk. Mm. They found blood in the car. They took evidence, DNA evidence of the blood of both of the areas in the vehicle that they found. I mean, so they did a phenomenal job.
Great.
Of documenting the evidence. And if they hadn't done such a good job, we wouldn't have that case in the Eastern District of California starting right there. So, I mean, again, our working relationship with, you know, California Fish and Wildlife, Department of Fish and Wildlife Service, phenomenal. For, because I think they knew at that point, we didn't know, obviously, but I think they knew this probably we're going to go the federal route with this. Even though they issued citations, they transferred the case over to us. And then we, the AUSA, filed those in the Eastern District.
Oh, okay. So after that contact, when they made that stop, they issued Kedura Clark and his pal, state citations. So they kind of arrested, cited, and released, I guess. Is that right?
Yeah.
And then how did U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service get involved after that? Did the wardens reach out to you and Bo Stone or what?
So they contacted the Fresno office.
So 2007 with the state game wardens, that's the first time Clark had ever been charged, even though he'd kind of been on radar screens for years before that. Okay.
Right. So this is a big deal. We had a supervisor up in Oregon had cooperating private individuals or CPIs, we call them, you know, informants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had informants up in Oregon who were reporting to supervisors up there that were making it down to California about Kedura Clark.
Interesting. Okay.
And so Kedura Clark is well known.
Yeah.
I mean, he was well known up and down the West Coast of being somebody that was a nefarious player on the powwow circuit, somebody who was a bad actor, somebody that, you know, needed to be looked into, somebody that was killing eagles. Again, he was well known to the major players out there who were illegally trading in eagle parts, and people knew that Kedura was charging upwards of $3,000 at that time for a full eagle, upwards of $450 for certain parts, like maybe a tail fan or a talon or a head. He would charge upwards of $450. But again, what you know, what you can prove, two different things. So and this was significant.
Yeah, this is significant. And this actually raises what you're learning here, raises another federal wildlife law that could kick in, which would be the Lacey Act. And the Lacey Act, basically, it would be a felony to transport any wildlife item, any wildlife taken in violation of federal law that's valued at more than $350, which all he has to do, if he shoots an eagle and he picks it up and he puts it in his car, that's transport. It doesn't have to cross a state line if the triggering law would be federal. So Lacey Act would trigger a felony, which would be up to 5 years in prison and a $250,000 fine. So now you've got some good violations that you could potentially hit Kedura Clark with. You mentioned that this initial state charge that happened in 2007, resulting from this traffic stop in 2007, now you've got, it's almost like you've got Kedura Clark cold. Finally, it's like, we got him, right? I mean, here we got dead eagles. We got a guy with eagle parts in his car, firearms, blood. Yeah. It was a good case. But you mentioned that it started as a state case, but got transferred to the feds. So was he, how did that work? What was he charged with by the feds and when? When and with what?
There's actually a lot that happened in between when he was actually charged. A few other things happened.
Okay, what happened?
He actually wasn't charged until June of 2010.
Yeah, with the stuff that happened as a result of this eagle shooting in progress, the charges didn't come down till 2010, right?
On the Fed side, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So another one of the things that the wardens did, though, which I think is worth mentioning, is that he took a field temperature of the eagle before they collected it, which was, it was 104 degrees body temperature.
Nice.
Which actually was quite significant as far as determining, time of death.
Yeah, right.
On the eagle, which gave him very little wiggle room on time, poaching eagle call coming in, them making contact with the cars, the chase ensuing, them finding the eagle. That was all very significant. So again, a lot of kudos to them for doing what they did. That was all very significant. So in that contact, and then December of 2007, and really the incident happened around December 16th, but it was December 26th, your office in Torrance, an agent gets a call from FedEx in the local LA area that a package was returned from Canada that was broken up, and there was looked like there was some animal parts in there, which upon inspection was bald and golden eagle parts.
Oh, okay.
And upon further investigation on that day, turned out to be a one Kedora Clark had attempted, well, not attempted, but he had mailed this FedEx package to a subject in Canada without the proper permits. It was labeled as Hopi dolls or, you know, curios, certainly not eagle bald feathers. And golden eagle parts. Right. And didn't have the proper CITES permits that would that Canada requires for that, but certainly not authorized for export on the U.S. side. So now we're looking at two violations, you know,
right,
for Kedora.
And this second that would have been a smuggling charge, which is export smuggling is a serious felony. That's 10 years. You're looking 10 years at max. Yep.
Lacey Act.
Yep. Smuggling.
I mean, false labeling. 18 USC 545 smuggling.
Yep.
Migratory bird treaty act violations. I mean, you're really stepping in it on that one.
So this is a guy. This is a guy who just a few months before had been charged or contacted by state game wardens for poaching in progress. And a few months later, he's continuing to ship eagle parts out of the country. Yeah.
Like 2 weeks later, 2-3 weeks later.
Okay.
All right. Just a few weeks later. Yeah. Clearly nice. Somebody who hasn't learned their lesson.
No,
yeah.
Has not learned their lesson.
No. Because it was late November that they had this contact, and it was just like December 16th that he mails the parts out via FedEx. And, you know, it wasn't until December 26th that they got the package back. So,
right.
You know, there's some time delay there, but yeah, I mean, when the dates are all figured out, I mean, this all happened in pretty short succession.
And this is, the shipment went out of, it went out through FedEx in Southern California, I guess. Is that right?
Right. So now we're in the Central District.
Yeah. So you've got him now in two different judicial districts, right? You've got him on in Eastern California for charges on the poaching incident.
Right.
And then now you've got a smuggling incident down in the Central District of California, which would be LA. Okay. So when does he get charged? I think if I remember right, he got charged with the Northern California or Eastern California stuff earlier, right? Wasn't he charged in eventually charged federally? Yeah.
So January of 2008.
Yeah.
Back when we could still dress up as FedEx or UPS employees.
Right.
We did a controlled delivery anticipatory search warrant.
Ah, okay. Explain what that is for listeners who aren't law enforcement.
Right. So that is a search warrant that you're going to serve on the contingency that they accept the package.
Got it.
So you're going to do a controlled delivery of a package. In this case, it was the FedEx package that was returned to the United States that he had attempted to ship out. And upon successful receipt of the package, that's when your search warrant becomes valid.
Got it. So you're actually, Clark doesn't even know at this point that his package was intercepted by Canadian authorities. Yeah.
Yeah. He doesn't know that. Well, he knows it's been returned to the United States.
But he doesn't
know that it's been intercepted by law enforcement.
Law enforcement. Yeah. He has no idea that you guys know what's in it. Okay, cool. So he just thinks he's getting the package back. That's perfect setup.
Right.
Yeah.
So back at least in 2008, they don't allow this practice anymore. But back in 2008, FedEx and UPS would still allow agents of different agencies to dress up as their carriers and participate in delivering in a controlled delivery.
I hate to tell you this, Sean, but in Southern California, we never cared what FedEx thought about that. In our closet, in our office, we had a couple of FedEx jackets. And after 2008, we routinely dressed as FedEx employees to deliver packages.
I don't know what year they stopped doing it. I don't.
Yeah, I don't remember either, but we didn't really care. I mean, we had the jackets. It didn't really matter.
Fair enough. Yeah.
As long as it's not a policy of the Fish and Wildlife Service, we didn't care what FedEx thought.
Okay. Yeah. I only learned of that when I was a rack in New Jersey. And we were doing a lot of controlled deliveries and we were trying to coordinate with FedEx.
Yeah.
And, well,
it used to be, they'd let us dress up like them and drive their trucks and stuff. And that's what they don't do anymore. We had to kind of fake it and pretend our truck was parked down the street when we did a delivery dressed as one of them. But anyway, that's a total aside.
Anyway, so
you do your, you have your package delivered. And so you execute the search warrant.
Yeah. So we working with Cal Fishing Game and, we did the joint anticipatory search warrant with the controlled delivery. They made it fun on us because they accepted the package. Kedora Clark was there along with Thompson and some other people. After package is delivered, they take receipt of it.
Nice.
Clark and another subject was coming out. We decided to go in. They ran.
Okay.
Oh, they ran. They made it fun. You don't always get runners, but this case they ran.
Did you chase them down?
Oh yeah, it was on. And, but Clark and the other guy, Clark wasn't running far.
He's a little overweight. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he, even in a walk, it looked like that was his dead sprint, but, he gassed out pretty quick. Mm-hmm. The other guy was a runner. He put on a good chase. The guy with the package, though, he went out the back door.
Ah.
So we didn't see where he went, but he went into hopped a fence and was hiding. And so it took some time to find him, but we found him. And so he made it interesting.
Yeah, that's a fun one.
But yeah, that was fun. He made it fun for us. We pulled an incredible amount of stuff out of that house.
Wow. Eagle stuff?
Oh, gosh, yeah. I mean, I think the tally was I think when all was said and done, I think the lab up in Oregon, when they tallied it up for us, I want to say that they equated all the evidence to equal about 10 different eagles.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, we have at least 10 eagles.
I think our listeners know from previous episodes, we have a forensic crime lab specifically dedicated to fish and wildlife cases. It's actually run by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service up in Ashland, Oregon. So that's nice. They did the forensic work for you. That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And so they attributed about at least 10 eagles out of that haul. And then several other owls, other migratory birds, raptors and whatnot, as you might expect. I mean, he's not going to just kind of have eagle feathers. I mean, he had all kinds of feathers. Registration paperwork. The search warrant is not the end of your case.
No, it's kind of the beginning. Of
the
that's where the paperwork. The real paperwork begins. Yeah.
There was a lot of work to do. So much work, in fact, that I had time to go fight a war and then come back.
Case was still there.
The case was still going on, and they were just charging Clark as I was coming back from Afghanistan. I mean, that's how much work there was to be done. That It's like, you have time to go fight a war in Afghanistan and then come back. And then you're like, where are we at? Oh, we're just getting ready to charter. But yeah. You know, sometimes the wheels of government can move slow.
Yeah. So, investigations can, thorough ones. So yeah, you were in the reserves and you were called up and you went to Afghanistan for a while there in the middle of your career. Yeah.
Right.
What was he charged with?
So we charged him with unlawful take of a golden eagle, unlawful possession of a golden eagle, and then unlawful possession of migratory bird parts.
Okay.
That was out of the Eastern District of California. Okay.
And what was the outcome of those charges?
He was officially sentenced in June of 2011.
But wait, did he go to trial or did he plead guilty eventually?
Well, he eventually pled guilty.
Oh, okay. Okay. He didn't go to trial.
And then he didn't go to trial. No.
Yeah. Okay.
He eventually struck a deal, and he, despite the evidence, which was overwhelming.
Yeah.
And again, and you know, as well as I do, sometimes despite your best evidence, sometimes deals are made that are beyond your control.
Well, once we give our case to the U.S. Attorney's office, it's not our case anymore. It's their case. So,
right. And I think where they had a problem was that there was no eyewitness account of him taking the eagle.
Ah, okay.
I mean, it's just, that's that one little hurdle that you can't get over, even though it was an eagle poaching call.
Yep.
There's nobody else in the area. The lab had come back with a necropsy report, which is an autopsy report for animals. I don't know if you've discussed that or not.
Yeah. But, yeah. Yeah.
So the necropsy report said that the eagle was killed with a small projectile. Mm. But they didn't have a bullet fragment preserved enough to match with any of the rifles.
Okay.
So we didn't have a link analysis to show that it directly came from one of his rifles, only enough to say that it could have come from like the 22 Magnum that we had seized.
So you had pretty good circumstantial case, but you didn't have that.
Yeah.
You didn't have that concrete, you know, somebody putting a gun in Kadura Clark's hand, firing the gun at an eagle, kind of, you know, which would have been, that would have been your slam dunk. So he pled guilty, cut a deal with the U.S. Attorney's Office. What did he end up getting convicted of?
So the one charge that they got him on was knowingly transporting a golden eagle because of the link analysis they had with the blood from the eagle that was collected. With the blood that was collected from the vehicle that they were able to solidly connect that eagle that was thrown out of the vehicle to the blood that was in the vehicle was one and the same.
Nice. That's cool.
So yeah, that was cool. So even though they couldn't get him on killing the eagle, which circumstantial evidence suggests there's nobody else in the area, who else could have done it?
Yeah.
He wouldn't admit to it. Neither did Thompson, but they did admit to, oh, we found the eagle. It was already dead. And then we threw it out.
God.
So they've got him admitting to transporting it and collecting it. So, hey, you know, that's still a violation.
Yep. Still a violation.
But that's all we needed.
Yep.
Because we got him on the misdemeanor.
Right.
So we got him on that. So, he got 6 months of unsupervised probation.
Okay.
So, and that was in the Eastern District. So,
but this is important because you're laying, you know, some people are like, what? He only got 6 months of unsupervised probation. But the real important thing here is you laid down a record, right?
Right.
So finally, you've been looking at this guy since at least 2002. Now, you know, not when I say you, I mean Fish and Wildlife and the state agencies, California Department of Fish and Wildlife and the feds have been looking at Clark since 2002, but now you finally got a record. He's down as a convicted eagle transporter. And that's that baseline, right? So if you catch him again, now the penalties are going to start getting more and more harsh if you start to catch him again, right?
Right.
Yeah, so, so good.
So I was very excited at that point to call my friend and yours, Dennis Mitchell.
Dennis Mitchell, with, assistant U.S. attorney in the Central District of California. Yep, good guy.
Great AUSA.
Yep.
Was very excited to call him and let him know that we have secured that misdemeanor and let's start working on that felony in the Central District.
Uh-huh.
And so we started doing that. Of course, you know, Dennis is he got a lot on his plate.
Yeah.
And he's a busy AUSA.
He is. And Dennis is the kind of guy, just he works in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Los Angeles, and he specifically is part of their environmental crimes unit. So he works on a lot of our cases. But he's one of those guys that you got to catch him and you got to get him to commit on, once he makes a decision on Tuesday, you got to get him to commit, because if you go back and talk to him about the same thing on Wednesday, he might totally change his mind about it. So busy. I've never seen anybody have more files stacked on their desk and on the floor and in on chairs in their office than Dennis Mitchell. He'll take on everything.
It's organized chaos.
He knows where it all is, but it sure looks like there's going to be an avalanche of paperwork at any moment.
Yeah, because I would go down there on details, you know, because we issued a lot of subpoenas, and because I think we had, because we were set to go to trial in July.
So Cordura Clark, I think you got ahead of yourself. So eventually, does Clark get charged down in Southern California? Central District?
Yes. So it was, in August of 2012. Mm-hmm. So as you know, now that case ends in the Central District or in the Eastern District.
Right.
Now the case begins in the Central District.
Right. And this is the smuggling case involving eagle feathers shipped to Canada by FedEx.
Right.
Right.
So okay. Now we're starting that case.
Okay.
That's down in LA and I'm up in Sacramento.
Right.
And then trying to travel down there. And your office provided me a lot of assistance. And again, that's where having good working relationships with even people in your own agency helps. Because, you know, sometimes if it was just one little thing that needed to be done, you know, having an agent down there doing it for you was a great assistance to me.
Yeah.
Not having to go all the way down there.
I remember you were down at the U.S. Attorney's Office in L.A. on this case, like 8 or 9 o'clock at night one night. I remember I brought something down. I brought some boxes of stuff over to the U.S. Attorney's Office for you. I can't remember. I know we met at the loading dock at the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Yeah. Yeah. But, it was one of those things. Dennis was like, oh, yeah, we need this. We need this. And I'm like, Dennis, that's at the Torrance office.
Yeah.
And he's like, I need it.
Yep.
Yeah, and I gave you a call, and you were like, you were at home.
Yeah, but yeah.
You drove to the office and got it and brought it over.
I didn't live too far from the office, so that worked out. And I always like to be out at night in L.A. anyway working. So, so he gets indicted in Central District for the smuggling charge. Is that what Dennis did for you?
Yeah, so we eventually get him indicted in August of 2012, on 4 counts of false labeling, Lacey Act, the 545 smuggling outside of the U.S.
Right.
And then unlawful export of bald and golden eagle outside of the U.S. And then illegal possession of migratory bird parts.
Okay, nice.
So 4 count indictment.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Kind of touching on
felonies in there. So Lacey, felonies.
Yeah, Lacey, 18 USC, bald and golden eagle, and MBTA. So
yeah,
good profile, good roundabout profile there. That felt pretty good.
So what happens? Yeah. Explain what happens when somebody's indicted. Did Clark? Was an arrest warrant issued, or was he summonsed in after he was indicted. Do you remember?
Yeah. So, yeah, Dennis and I talked about that. And we, so one of two things can happen. You can issue a summons and just say, hey, we would like you to come in.
You're required to come in. You've been indicted.
Well, you're required. You need to show up. Yeah. Yes, that's putting it too nicely. Yes, you're required to come in, but we're giving you this option of coming in on your own accord.
Right.
And here's the date and time that you're required to come in.
Yep.
And you know, be read these charges, or we can just issue an arrest warrant and not tell you about it. And then at a time of our place in choosing, we will come and find you and put on those iron handcuffs and, you know, bracelets, and then bring you in when it's convenient for us. And then that's usually a surprise to the individual. And we felt that that was more appropriate in this situation for a lot of reasons.
Second offense.
Second offense, the fact that we just didn't feel that Clark was taking this seriously.
Well, there's some people that learn a lesson and some people that don't. That's just the bottom line. Yeah.
Right. And it's bottom line. And he wasn't learning a lesson.
Yeah. You got an arrest warrant. You had an arrest warrant for him after the indictment, huh?
We did. And the other reason is we couldn't find him.
Mm.
We had no idea where he was.
Okay.
And it's hard to issue a summons if you don't know where he is.
Right.
So, in that sense, we had to issue an arrest warrant because, like, go find him.
Right.
You know?
And so how do you do that? What'd you do? Once you had your arrest warrant in hand, you don't know where he is. How do you go about making this arrest?
Of course, this is where you kind of come into this story.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to get involved in this, which was a very fun thing for me because during my career, I actually had a number of opportunities to chase down fugitives, and I loved it. I loved doing that. It was one of my favorite things to do. So the mechanics of this are once an arrest warrant is issued, the U.S. Marshals put it into NCIC so that, if perhaps Kadura Clark's pulled over for a traffic violation and the local police, you know, do a routine check on him, it should pop up and they should say, oh, he's got an arrest warrant, and they should arrest him for you. So you kind of have that out there. There's the chance that Kadura Clark could get contacted by a local police officer on a routine traffic stop and get picked up that way. Yeah. But also you can kind of send this warrant out to different agents in the service and presumably you don't know where he is, but you have some ideas where he might be. Right. And I think that's why you called me, because you had an idea he might be in Southern California. Isn't that, if that's, that's my recollection of it in any way, isn't it?
Yeah. We knew he had a girlfriend that was down in Southern California. He had his ex-wife, was in Southern California. He had two boys. So we knew that he had ties to the LA area. And so that was, there was no information that we had that had him. He had been up in Sacramento and in Northern California at times.
Right.
But all the information that we had suggested that he was either out of the state and was, you know, in South Dakota or Montana, Denver, or he was in LA.
I remember you told me you had sent some leads out to other agents in other states. I believe South Dakota was one of them, to kind of say, hey, can you see if you can find this guy? Do you remember what you did personally, like up in your area? Did you try to find him? What steps did you take to find him?
Well, we hit all the hot spots that we knew he was known to either stay at, or people that he knew or hung out with. I mean, all the areas that you would canvass.
Yeah.
Any of the powwows we would hit. Any associates or known associates. You know, long hours.
Looking for him. Just looking.
Looking.
I mean. So I'll jump in here, because this is one of the neat things about being a special agent with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We have agents all over the country. You mentioned you reached out to Agent Brad Merrill in South Dakota, thinking maybe, you know that Clark's got connections with Native Americans. He likes to kind of tell people he's a Native American. He's obviously selling feathers in that community. So there's a chance he could show up out there at a powwow or on a reservation. So you were able to reach out to Agent Merrill for some help on that. Brad couldn't find him. You've got yourself and other agents in Northern California looking, but you also were able to just reach out to our office and you called me. And I'll tell you, I did similar things. So here's what I did. First of all, whenever I got a call from an agent from outside my district, I kind of made that my priority because I always thought one of the greatest strengths of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is that we have this network of agents, right?
Yeah.
So I loved it. When I would get a call from an agent from outside my district who said, hey, Ed, I need your help. Can you do X, Y, or Z? I always kind of tried to make that my highest priority because I just thought that is the strength that our agency has in law enforcement that, say, state agencies do not have. We can just pick up the phone and make a call to an agent we know in that area, and they will kind of become an extension of us. So when you called me and you said, hey, we can't find this guy, we need to find him, I was like, okay, now I am Sean Mann. This is, you know, I'm thinking like Sean. I want to get this guy. And I made it my priority. And I kind of did what you did up north. I just started going to powwows in Southern California looking for him, right? I mean, I literally had the arrest warrant in my pocket. And I'd go to the powwows and look for this guy. And I couldn't find him. And then we started to do surveillance on an address in Pacoima that turned out his brother-in-law or something was... There were people living there who were renting the house from Kadura Clark's either brother or brother-in-law. I can't remember, but they claimed they didn't know where he was. But we did surveillance on that house for weeks, and we never saw him. Mm-hmm. And then this is where we finally got him in L.A. We finally got him in Southern California. And I'll tell you, the way we got him, Sean, is like you, I always took advantage of networking with other agencies. And there are... what are called fusion centers in law enforcement. They're all over the U.S., and they're centers, usually in urban areas, where different law enforcement agencies will have representatives, and you're able to blast out messages among many, many law enforcement agencies very quickly. So I put together like a little arrest package on Clark. It had a wanted poster that I made for him. It had, you know, the warrant. It had kind of his basic details on who he was, who he associated with, what kind of cars he might be driving. And I blasted this out to every single law enforcement agency in Southern California, LAPD, Riverside Sheriff's Office, San Bernardino Sheriff's Office, local police. And, you know, you kind of do that with a bit of a, you know, maybe a shyness because you're like, hey, among all of the drug dealers and bank robbers and murderers you guys are looking for, here's an ego trafficker you might want to keep your eyes open for. But you know what? To my surprise, the local fugitive units, like LAPD has a fugitive unit. Most of the sheriff's department have fugitive units that look for people who have active warrants. And those guys were super interested in this case. I mean, they were fascinated by this case. And I will never forget your reaction when I called you. I believe it was 2013. I had sent out the messages, and basically I got a phone call from the head of the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Office SWAT team. And he told me, hey, we've been looking for your guy. And we noticed that one of the license plates you sent us has been popping up on a license plate reader at the local courthouse. And we waited that car. We waited for it. We followed that car. And we saw a woman go into an apartment and come out again. And when she walked down the street, we kind of stopped her. And we found out it was Kadura Clark's girlfriend. And he was living in the apartment. So basically, the SWAT team took our warrant and hit that apartment. And they arrested Kadura Clark on, I think it was May 30th, 2013. And I remember when I called you and you were like... What? The San Bernardino Sheriff's Office SWAT team just arrested Kadura Clark. That was a pretty fun day.
Yeah.
Do you remember getting that call from me?
I do. Well, oddly enough, it's, you know, that was, well, it was my son's birthday. And I thought, hey, you know, what a perfect day. You know, I mean, you know, Kadura is my son's birthday and Kadura Clark gets arrested, you know?
Yeah, no kidding. So we finally get him into custody and he's processed down here in Southern California. It's kind of nice because they, sheriff's office arrested him. Then the marshals took him over to the jail. We didn't even have to like physically deal with him.
Right.
What was the outcome then in Southern California? Obviously he's indicted. Did he plead or go to trial on that part?
So he ended up pleading guilty. Mm. I mean, we had an airtight case against him.
Yeah.
You know, during grand jury in doing subpoenas, we had gotten the FedEx video
right
from inside the store. Yeah, no way he's saying that it's not me. I mean,
yeah, there's so many other cool aspects to this case we haven't had a chance to talk about, like that surveillance video from the FedEx store showing him drop off the package, right?
Right.
It's pretty good stuff.
So we had such great evidence against him.
Yeah. So what was the outcome of the Southern California case?
Well, he ended up pleading guilty to the one count of the false labeling charge.
Ah, okay. Still a felony.
Which kind of, yeah. And so, but there was, to my surprise, there was no jail time. Mm. But so he ended up doing 3 years of supervised probation.
Okay.
So, and he got 100 hours of community service.
Okay.
So, any
subsequent evidence of him continuing to kill or traffic in Eagle parts?
You know, I don't know, because it was not shortly after that, maybe a year and a half after that, that I ended up transferring to FLETC.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, he was still been on probation.
Yeah.
Or at least during his probationary period, I ended up, well, you ended up leaving.
In 2015, going, yeah. Going to Africa.
Going overseas. And then I left to go to FLETC. So you and I both left region one, or at least region eight at that time now.
We never heard about him again after that, though. He never popped up on anybody's radar screen. You know, I remained in Southern California until 2015. And then in 2020, I came back until 2022 when I retired. And he never popped up on our radar screen again. So I don't know. As far as I know, Sean, you shut him down.
Yeah, either that or COVID got him. I don't know. I mean, one upper respiratory disease would have taken that man out. I don't know what happened to him.
That's an interesting concept. That's actually an interesting note to end on, Sean, because we're just about out of time. But you know, he didn't go to jail on that second one, which is a little surprising, but it was a harsher sentence. And he didn't pop up on the radar screen again, whether it was because he learned his lesson or because of COVID. I don't know. But
I hope he learned his lesson.
I hope we'll just assume he learned his lesson.
And I hope he's alive and well.
Yeah, me too. But Sean, I appreciate you coming on to tell us this story. Eagle trafficking or feathers trafficking in eagle feathers is not something that a lot of people think about. It still goes on. Yeah. It still happens. Yeah. There is some illegal activity going on among the powwows with people illegally selling feathers. It's something the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is always looking at and always aware of. So I appreciate you coming on to tell the story. And it's great to see you again. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah, I love it, Ed. Thanks. I love being on here. Great to see you.
Fantastic. All right, everybody. Thanks for joining us for this week's episode of Nature's Secret Service. If you want more information about Sean's case, you can find it on the website at naturesecretservice.com. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. Nature's Secret Service is written and produced by me, Ed Newcomer, and is co-produced by the DHTV team here at California State University, Dominguez Hills. Follow us on social media and connect with us online at naturesecretservice.com.